Okay, so very good to be here again. And as I mentioned, I was able to be on retreat the entire month of March. And I wanted to share some this evening about the retreat, about the nature of a long retreat, and partly share from my own experience, but partly make connection between some of the themes that came up and how we can practice those in daily life. So it's not going to be just about my retreat, but it'll also make connections, hopefully, with everyone's experience and not see, this as some esoteric, purely esoteric time away in some exalted place. Even though it was a beautiful time away in an exalted place with getting 3 meals a day cooked for me. And I had one of my memorable experiences was for the first time in my entire life being served a dish based on tofu for dessert. Anyone ever had a dessert dish based on tofu? Well, I didn't think it was possible. So this was tofu mixed with ginger and syrup. It was okay, but I'm not looking for the recipe. Okay. And so I was at Spirit Rock for 4 weeks, and what the weather was like and March. It rained a lot, sometimes windy. It was interesting. I mostly just stayed in my own room and meditated. I didn't really go to the hall particularly, and I just did my own practice pretty much. Except for I did go to every meal. I also had a job. Cleaning 2 bathrooms, which is my favorite job. And this time, maybe more than others, I saw deeply into human nature while cleaning the bathrooms. Noticing, especially at the beginning of the retreat, how even though there was a bag marked for trash and a bag marked for brown paper towels, which could be composted, virtually every day, people didn't follow the guidelines. This is a retreat developing mindfulness. Then also a lot of the brown paper towels never found their way to either basket. They were just on the floor. And this seemed to happen more the first week and the last week. The second and third week, it was way better. So when I write a book, this will be part of my inquiry into human nature. Okay. So I want to really talk about three themes. And the first theme came out of the way that I decided what my focus would be for the retreat. Interestingly, I went into the retreat not knowing what my focus would be. I thought it might well be what I had done the year before, which is a mix. I actually was doing some more, two advanced Tibetan practices, one of them called Tummo, inner fire practice. And the other one it comes out of a text called The Six Lamps, which is about the transformation of perception into where one only sees light. Not bad. And then the third practice, which was my default practice, which I did more of the time, was radiating metta, having a sense of loving kindness coming out of my heart and going into a big space and holding everything in the big space with loving kindness, which is a wonderful practice. So I'd walk around, and there'd be radiating metta with the trees and the other people. And maybe I can teach that another time. It's not a hard practice, but it's glorious. It can be done at home and so forth. So I went in thinking I probably would do that, but I had also had some thoughts about doing concentration practice. And I knew about a set of recordings from a teacher named Rob Berbea, who was an English teacher. I mean, a teacher who was English, I should say. A teacher who was English, who wrote a very brilliant book, unusual book called Seeing That Frees, which came out in 2015, which I had read. And I also knew that he had taught a retreat on the more advanced concentration practices called the jhanas, which are deep states of more advanced concentration. And he had done that 5 months before he died. He had he was diagnosed in 2015 with pancreatic cancer and died in May of 2020. And the retreat was in December and January of 2019 and 2020. And so I did my other practices the first few days, and I felt, I tried to listen for what was calling. And I felt really called to explore the concentration practice and to do it the whole month, partly because he was teaching the practice of jhanas, that's J-H-A-N-A, that the Buddha taught. Generally speaking, there are two systems of more advanced samadhi or concentration. One of them comes from the teaching of the Buddha and is actually much more accessible, not such deep states. And the other comes from a text for about 8 or 9 centuries after the Buddha called the Visuddhimagga, Path of Purification, which came out of, I believe, Sri Lanka, what's now Sri Lanka. And that's, that gives the way of practicing that has, well, until recently, was primarily the way that was transmitted to the West through Burmese teachers. And I had practiced several, I had done several long retreats practicing the Visuddhimagga jhanas, which are much deeper, harder to get into. But this one was on the teachings of the Buddha. And so I tried to listen, and I felt this calling, really, in myself to work with the recording, because the recordings are all on the website Dharma Seed, the entire 23-day retreat. You can listen to it. And I found Robert Bay a beautiful teacher, very kind of unusual background. He was, his father was from, was born in Libya and was actually a Sephardic Jew who was caught up by the Nazis and spent time in concentration camps along with his father. And he eventually went to England and married an English woman. That's Rob's background. And he initially wanted to be a jazz guitarist and studied in the U.S. And later he went back to England and became a teacher who was quite beloved. But the theme that I wanted to connect to our experience is, how do we know what calls us? How do we know what comes from our depths in terms of making decisions, especially major decisions? In terms of what is the next step that I want to take in my spiritual practice? And I think there's something really crucial about listening deeply to oneself and knowing what calls one. You know, and even the notion of the calling is a very powerful concept in Western tradition. You know, the sense of the calling is part and is linked to the word for vocation. You know, the word, you know, knowing what one's life purpose is. How do we know that? How do we listen deeply for what's calling? The word vocation comes from the word, the first part from the word vox, which means voice. It's like hearing the voice. A similar etymology, actually, with the word ecclesia, which was the name for the first Christian churches. It's a Greek word, and it literally means the meeting of those who are called, who hear the calling. You know, can you think of times when you've had an important decision and you check in internally, like, you know, what should be my work? Who should I marry? You know, should I do this? Should I do that? And how do we listen deeply to that voice? How do we know what our next step is in spiritual practice? When I work with people individually, and I mentor people, one of the ways that I see what I'm doing is trying to most myself intuitively get a sense of what their next step is and see if they can have that sense as well. And then we know where to go. You know, do we know what our kind of learning edge is, our growing edge is in spiritual practice or in life more generally? I think that's really, really crucial. How do we listen carefully for what's there? I've had a guideline for several decades of not making major decisions without the decisions coming out of some period of quiet listening, like at least a day or two of meditating before I make a major decision, you know, so I can listen. So, you know, and if we've done retreats, we know sometimes at the end of the retreats, our intuitive voices are more apparent. So how do we find that inner voice? How do we listen? You know, it could be to, I think regular meditation helps, knowing and being able to distinguish the different voices, which is a voice that I can really trust, which is giving me a deeper intuition. What is an old pattern or an old habit? And even, I think, asking the question in daily life and listening for a response can be a beautiful practice. I remember when I studied the Hakomi approach to body-based psychotherapy, one of our teachers was, what was his name? Rob, I think it was John Eisman from Eugene, Oregon. And John had a way of touching into what's authentic. This is another word for what we're looking for. And he said that at every moment, there's an organic impulse. There's something that's genuine and authentic. And he said that it's there more when we're very young. And gradually, that authentic impulse can get covered over. He said it particularly gets covered over by what he called the committee, which is the committee of all the different opinions that we have, right? So how do we touch that deeper voice, that intuitive truth? That's the first theme I want to bring up. How can I do that more? You know, how can I have a quiet? How can I, it might be again to maybe at the end of a meditation, let me ask a question, which is live for me, and stay and listen intuitively for what comes up. I think it's a crucial part of our lives, isn't it? Really knowing what's authentic and being able to increasingly live from that authentic voice, live from our deep, authentic impulses. So what I thought was my authentic impulse was to do concentration practice. And at the end of the retreat, I would say, yes, that was a good decision. That was authentic. That was really listening to my voice. But we could talk more about that, that quality of listening deeply. You know, at home I have on my wall, you can see it next week with the, when we do Zoom, I have an image of the Tibetan great yogi Milarepa with his hand listening like that. It's a beautiful metaphor for an important quality of our practice. Second theme is that of developing samadhi. And I loved developing samadhi for a whole month. I had done other retreats where I did that. So I think I had had a lot of learning, made a lot of mistakes, so to speak. I sometimes share, I don't know if I've shared this here, but sometimes I think what makes a really good teacher is someone who's made all sorts of mistakes, made more mistakes than other people. And so I can then, you know, say, okay, look out here, look out there. I know that one. So in terms of concentration, I think the first time I did a long concentration practice, I got caught up in what we might call achievement mentality, which is one of the dangers. I want to get there. I want to get to this level of concentration. And I was in that retreat, I was practicing metta, and it was so beautiful. I was strengthening loving kindness for 5 weeks. It was beautiful. And I was complaining part of the retreat because I was also practicing the jhanas, and I didn't get to where I had some progress, but I didn't get to where I wanted to. And at a certain point, I realized that, I said, look, Donald, you're suffering and you're trying to get somewhere. All the time, every moment, you're developing this beautiful quality of loving kindness. No. Okay. Maybe shifts. Learn from this, right? So the next long concentration retreat that I did, I worried way, way less. And in fact, I don't think I worried about achievement. And also I was working with one of these more difficult systems, from a Burmese teacher named Paok Sayadaw. And a little bit before I went in the retreat, I heard that several senior insight teachers, much more senior than me, I don't know if I should name them, that they had not got very far with going in this system of concentration. And I felt, okay, that plus my suffering from 4 years before, it just took all the pressure off. And of course, I made good progress because I didn't need to. Right? So that's something that's really an important aspect to this. So I was just focusing on the breath, sitting in my room, doing this for months, you know, and again, I had, you know, I've been practicing for over 45 years, so a lot of development. So the samadhi is pretty well developed. And of course, the main aim of all of this is to be able to not be dominated by our automatic mind, by our conceptual mind, by all the thinking, right? That, you know, I know when I first started meditating, I was a student and I was thinking all the time. And if I had to give a little presentation in a seminar, all my meditations would be thinking about it. And I noticed that, gosh, I'm thinking all the time. I'm planning all, especially planning, you know, because I come from a planning family. You know, I think I've sometimes mentioned that my sister has a master's degree in planning, right? Actually urban planning. And she's made her livelihood planning. She was a administrator doing a lot of planning for Kaiser. And she just retired like a year ago. And of course, planning is really necessary, but in meditation, we're wanting to focus. So we want to cut through that automatic mind. And we keep doing that, don't we? Right? We do it for a while, then the automatic mind comes back. But as the concentration deepens, if we keep doing, developing samadhi, and I prefer to use the original word samadhi, as we keep doing that, if we keep developing samadhi, the baseline level of samadhi will increase. The neuroscientific research on developing samadhi shows that if we keep practicing developing samadhi, where I am now will be better. My baseline, what happens right when I start, will be better than it was 5 years ago. Samadhi is learned by the brain. It's not back to square one every time. So that's really a hopeful sign that we can really build it. And I totally see that personally. You know, I can see that, you know, the baseline now is way, way better than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago as I've been practicing quite a bit of samadhi. From the Buddha, practitioners develop samadhi. A practitioner who is concentrated understands things as they really are. Without the peace of samadhi, without attaining to calm, without one-pointedness, that one should enter and abide in the emancipation of mind and heart, that cannot happen. So samadhi is necessary for freedom, for greater freedom. So just a few words about the jhanas. So I practiced again the system of the Buddha from the Buddha, and I listened to the talks from Robert Beah and the instruction. They're accessible for you on Dharma Seed. They're wonderful. I loved his teaching. I never heard him talk. I loved his book. But he's a beautiful, creative, heartfelt teacher. Really, I never heard him teach. And I loved. So I just would be in my room listening to talks. I would take notes on my computer and then print them out. So I'd have the notes. And I really, you know, doing that, I would listen to, an hour talk. And I would listen to it basically 2 or 2.5 hours. And the first part was ways to develop more samadhi. And the last maybe 3/4 of the retreat was giving teachings on these 8 jhanas, these 8 levels of developing samadhi. And I also read Lee Brazington's book on developing samadhi, which is called Right Concentration, Practicing the Jhanas. And he is a local teacher who offers retreats on these. And what's really interesting, the teachings that come from the Buddha, the jhanas, these more advanced, more deep states, are pretty accessible. If we have a regular practice, I would say that they can be accessible in a little bit longer retreat. And I found them completely accessible. They were very different from the jhanas from the Burmese tradition that I had studied. These were all accessible. And they're quite beautiful. It was like hanging out in beautiful states open to human beings for weeks. Yeah. And one friend of mine who is a meditator, who is a beautiful practitioner, who I talk with every few weeks, she said that these states are really like, when you're in them, it's like an offering to other beings, an offering to humanity, because they're beautiful states. And I was basically hanging out in these for about the last 3 of the 4 weeks. And I'll mention what they are. And then in a little while, we can open things up. The first jhana is basically that of the pleasure, and we might say bliss of the body. In the Pali language, it's called piti, P-I-T-I. And this is another way of talking about it. This is tuning in to the subtle energy of the body, which is basically pleasurable, which naturally occurs as we meditate. And having that be dominant, having this sense, so I would be there and I'd just be with my whole body filled with pleasant, subtle energy. You know, for many hours a day. Very nice. This is from the Buddha, his description. A practitioner, secluded from the hindrances, enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with initial and sustained thinking, filled with rapture and happiness. One drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses one's body with his rapture and happiness, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused with rapture and happiness. And that's accessible. Not a deep advanced state. One can experience this. Not so hard. You know, it can, again, can take a little while. And so that's the first jhana. The second jhana is the thinking. There's still some thinking with the first jhana. The second level of absorption, the thinking really decreases. There's still some of that body rapture, but the emphasis is on what's called sukha, or happiness. And so one's just sitting there, tuning into happiness. And with the level of concentration and following with the first jhana, it seems accessible. And so I would just sit there feeling basically happy. And interestingly, I would feel the first jhana I felt with my whole body. The second one I felt more around the heart. And there was a kind of happiness that was just there no matter what was happening. And I thought of that experience I had had quite a while ago when I was on retreat, where I had a similar experience without at all trying to practice concentration, where I woke up one day, I was at a retreat, I hadn't slept well, my body didn't feel good, I was irritated, and I felt a deep happiness. Isn't that interesting? Happiness was basically from being there, you know. And probably think of an experience you've had. Have you had an experience like that where things weren't going well in some ways, but you could still tune into happiness? It was like the big picture was happiness. Anyone think of something like that? Yeah. It was really, really interesting. And, you know, I thought of, you know, in that experience, just hanging out, feeling happiness no matter what was going on. It was just like a human potential to tune into happiness no matter what's going on, just by going inwardly. Again, and one of the powerful aspects of these states is that one finds inward glories that are always accessible no matter what's happening. And I thought of a very powerful passage that I remembered from the journal of Etty Hillesum. Anyone know her work? She was a young woman living in Amsterdam in the Netherlands at the time of the Nazi occupation in 1940. She was Jewish. Etty, E-T-T-Y, Hillesum, H-I-L-L-E-S-U-M. She kept a journal during the time of the occupation. She was eventually killed at Auschwitz. The journal survived. And there's one passage, actually several passages, but one in particular I remembered practicing with this heart energy. And this is it. It was about a happiness that she felt even in quite horrible conditions. This is the passage. The misery here, this was from when she was in an internment camp before she was sent to Auschwitz. The misery here is quite terrible. And yet late at night, when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with a spring in my step along the barbed wire. And then time and again, it soars straight from my heart. I can't help it. That's just the way it is, like some elementary force. The feeling that life is glorious and magnificent. And that one day we shall be building a whole new world. Can you imagine that? I thought of that, experiencing that happiness, no matter what was going on. It was quite powerful. I'll just mention in passing, the third jhana was contentment and peacefulness. This was located, in my experience, a little bit lower down around my belly. The fourth was stillness, equanimity, and luminosity filling one's consciousness. The fifth was infinite space. The fifth through the eighth were called the formless jhanas, no longer connected with the body, really. The fifth was infinite space. The sixth is infinite consciousness, infinite awareness. And these are, again, they sound a little mystical or mysterious. They're actually pretty accessible. Not so hard. And the seventh is nothingness. And the eighth is neither perception nor non-perception. The Buddha was kind of getting out there a little bit. Okay. And so we'll just close with the last one was, my interest was, how do I bring my retreat home? Crucial theme for Marin Sangha that Philip Moffitt emphasized all the time. How do I connect my meditation with my daily life? And so at the end of the retreat, I gave myself, I've done this a lot. I gave myself 18 guidelines for having the energy of the retreat continue at home. And I followed most of them. Some of them, mostly pretty simple ones, like following some of the patterns, you know. So, for example, I was inspired by cleaning the bathrooms every day after lunch. And so I said, every day after lunch, I will clean my house for half an hour and stay present. That was one of my 18. And I've done that. So anyway, I'll finish there because I want to leave time for our talking together. But and I've kept the practices going. I have found that these jhanas have been accessible pretty much just as much as in the retreat at home. And I love them, and I'm still doing them. So, and maybe sometime, I hesitate to do a day long on this. Anyone interested in a week long Marin Sangha retreat?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, maybe we can look into that option. Yeah.
Hybrid? Would it be hybrid?
The organizers, we could probably do something like that.
Okay. I just want Zoom.
Okay. No, I won't do any more planning. So let me invite everyone just to sit quietly for 30 seconds or a minute and see if there's something that resonated with you from the talk, any questions, something from the time of practice that would be helpful to bring up about how we practice developing samadhi. See what's there for you. So let me open it up now. Can anyone in the hall wants to raise their hand? I see Isabel wanted to share something or ask something, as does Jan and Patty. So we have three people online. Anyone here immediately have a? Yeah. It's the luminosity of the fourth jhana. Yeah, feel free to. Oh, I guess we can do a shade. Anyone here? Let me, get a sense of anyone here have something you want to share or ask? Okay, let's go with the what's brought up. I think Isabel, and then was Jan and Patty and Vita. Yeah, actually we have four now. Isabel, please.
I love your talk, Donald. I love samadhi. I mean, I Gil Fronsdell is doing a series on it at his 7 a.m. Meditations, and what you described is exactly what I've been experiencing, this sense of euphoria at times and this really connectedness with my body. And I'm kind of addicted to it now. So I was hoping you could, you mentioned a gentleman's name that there were 23 on the Dharma seed. So I'm hoping you can put that in his full name in the chat so I can look up those.
It's Rob, Rob, Burbea, Burbea.
Okay, good. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, and it's right, and he has a lot of other teaching on Dharma Seed. A beautiful teacher, like I said, I was so felt like such a kindred soul. And is Gil also teaching the jhanas?
Yeah, so we did the samadhi for a few weeks, and now we're on the second. We did the second jhana last week, and this week we're doing the third. So
Yeah, and you're finding them accessible even in the midst of daily life.
Yeah, and I definitely b agree with what you said about how you can have troubles in your life, but if the background is basically happiness, and I've been experiencing that in a big way.
Wow.
And I notice it. I notice it all the time. It's been pretty amazing. So I feel like
It's
truly blessed to
wonderful.
have you talk about it as well tonight. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. And yeah, I remember I've had discussions over the years with Gil about samadhi. And just to know that all those, is he still working with samadhi on his daily teaching?
Well, I know he's teaching it to us. I don't know about his personal practice.
No, but I meant it's 7 a.m. insight
Oh
meditation.
yeah, it's IMC. It's if you look up their website, there's a link there every morning at 7 to 7:30 we do the sit, and 7:30 to 7:45 he gives like a. It's great for people that work because you can just fit it in and then get on with your day.
And the recordings from past times should be right there.
They're there too, yep.
Great. Okay, Jan, please.
Well, you answered my first question, which was about the teacher on Dharma Seed. If you go look up concentration with Gil, you're going to find dozens of talks. We've been doing it for weeks now.
Wow, that's right. Yeah.
Like 30, I think maybe 30 talks. So it would be a lot. And I like your description of the jhanas, at the accessibility of them. That I think what I had in my mind, that they were the way they've been taught is, you have to get really concentrated and shut everything off. And gee, how much easier for me at least to just enjoy the experiences of the body, just get happy.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, the predominant system that's come to Western practitioners up until a little while ago was more this very high level of concentration. And the ones that the Buddha taught, as taught by people like Lee Brazington or Richard Shankman or Rob Burbea, among others, actually. Rob's primary teacher on the jhanas was Thanissara Bhikkhu, who has a monastery in San Diego area, American-born monk. Yeah, let me get to Patty and then Vita. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you, Donald. I had an experience before I ever heard of jhana. I didn't have the language for it, but on retreat once I described to my teacher what I was experiencing, and he said, oh, that's just rapture. Don't get attached to it. And I was blown away by like how it was so simple. Oh, that's rapture. Don't get attached to it. And that hadn't happened yet, but I think Gil is having an effect on me because the other morning, during my morning practice, I had an overwhelming feeling, like it came on like a sudden warm wave, an overwhelming feeling of total contentment and joy.
Yeah.
And it was the first time since that retreat years ago that I think I tapped into that. And I was so startled by it that I sort of jumped out of it because I was like, oh my God, there it is again. And I got out of it before I wanted to luxuriate in it, but I was so excited to feel it that I took myself out of it. But I never thought I would have it again, especially not on a retreat. But it happened the other morning during my morning meditation.
Very beautiful. Well, keep on going, Patty. It's part of your human inheritance. It's accessible.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Love the talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Maybe, I think last one, Vita, then we'll go to our closing.
Thank you. I just would like the, you mentioned the book, Right Concentration on the Jhanas. Who is the author?
Lee Brazington.
Oh, it is Lee Brazington.
Yeah.
Brazenton.
Brazington. And he offers retreats on the jhanas as locally, as does Richard Shankman.
Yes, Don Richards.
And then, but I found it wonderful to work with the recordings. It's a little cheaper than retreats as well. but yeah, I found that just the recordings are so rich. So yeah, Vita, please.
I just, that's all I needed. Thank you.
Okay.
And thank you. It's a really timely and thank you for this talk.
You're very welcome. It was fun to give. And if we had another 2 or 3 hours, could have a lot more to say. So let me ask people a question. I'm coming next week. It'll be online. And I can continue to talk about samadhi. That's one option. And I've also been reflecting on what on the surface seems like a very different theme, which is how to bring the teachings and practices into understanding what's going on in this country. And I could talk about that next week, or I could reserve that maybe until the next time I teach, which I think is June, and talk about samadhi next week. So I wanted to have a democratic choice to keep democracy going. maybe let me take, get the sense I could either go, you know, to something more related to an aspect of socially engaged Buddhist practice next week, or continue and invite everyone to continue with samadhi. You know, but I wouldn't talk about the other theme maybe until I think it's June that I come back. Hey, how many would like to continue with samadhi? Okay. And how many would be inclined to go to the theme of more the social engagement? What's the, as long as I do both. Yeah, I think it, my intuition right now, if I'm listening carefully and deeply, might be that, I mean, there may be a certain urgency about wanting to have a sense of about the world, but it would really flow. I think it was close to 50-50, wasn't it? I think it would probably flow with today to take next time on samadhi. Is that, are people okay with that? How many people are good with that? Okay. And then what I can invite you to do is to maybe right now set your intention for how to keep the development of samadhi going in your personal practice in the next week. And then we would continue next week, and I'd also have a lot of room for your reports, you know, about, and I'd talk more generally. I wouldn't focus exclusively on the jhanas. It'd just be more, how do we develop samadhi? What comes up in our practice? So take 30 seconds right now. Set your intention for next week on how to bring more cultivation of samadhi. Maybe to make an intention, even if you don't, if you're a little rusty with your daily practice, maybe make an intention to do it at least 10, 15, 20 minutes a day. Take about 20, 30 seconds now.